Dear Jesus, may I enter into the eternal divine order of God to place my absolute nothingness in the heart of the Most Holy Trinity, to give to my God the joy of fulfilling the purpose of my existence by doing all the acts of my life through the Immaculate Heart of my Mother Mary and in the divine will of God. And in this same manner, may I live, pray, act, eat, walk, sleep, and do everything. May my soul be devoid of any other longings, wants, or desires, and may you, my beloved divine will, do with me whatever you want or desire. All I ask is that you bind me to your most holy will so intimately that I may never swerve from carrying out what I know to be your good pleasure. Come, divine will, with all the angels and saints, especially my sweet Mother Mary, to touch my forehead, to imprint on it the Holy Spirit and infuse in me true light, so that I may understand the truths and the good that are in these writings and prayers. Amen. I want to begin with June the 21st, 1926. And here the Lord does something very beautiful. He brings Saint Aloysius out of heaven to teach Louisa something. So I want to tell you, before we read anything, that Saint Aloysius Gonzaga was an Italian from an aristocratic family. He was born in 1568 and he died in 1591 in Rome. He entered the Jesuit order and he was in his training for priesthood, and he became very much involved in trying to help the victims of an epidemic in Rome. And instead of protecting himself and getting himself inoculated against the disease, he went out among the people who were sick and he cared for the sick and the dying without any regard for himself. And he died at the age of 23 years. He was canonized in 1726. So Louisa said, "This morning, having received Holy Communion, I received it as usual in the most holy will of God. Offering it to my dear Saint Aloysius," she obviously felt close to him, "not only the communion but all the goods contained in the most holy will of God for his accidental glory. Now, while doing this, I saw that all the goods contained in the supreme volition, like many rays of light, rays of beauty and of multiple colours, inundated the dear saint, giving him an infinite glory. And my sweet Jesus, moving in my interior, told me, 'My daughter, Aloysius is a flower and a saint bloomed from the earth of my humanity.'" This is going to be very important because Jesus is explaining that before the divine will, all the saints came from the earth of his humanity. And now he expects us to come from his divine will. So this answers a question that many people beginning in the Divine Will study ask: how could the great canonized saints not be greater than us? Maybe that's not even a good way of putting the problem. Okay, but we'll look at it. So Jesus said that Aloysius is a flower and a saint that has bloomed from the earth of my humanity. And he was made bright by the reflections of the rays of the sun of the divine will. Now notice the reflections. He wasn't living in the divine will. Okay. "In fact, though holy, pure, noble, and united hypostatically to the word, my humanity was earth," because he became incarnate. "And Aloysius, more than a flower, bloomed from my humanity." In other words, he's one of the saints of the era of redemption. "He was pure, he was holy, he was noble, possessing the root of pure love." Now, this is extremely important because as you go through the writings of Louisa, it becomes perfectly clear that the whole issue is love. The whole issue of divine will is love, because God is love. And so if someone is canonized, i.e. they get to heaven, it means that they have done well in love. They have majored in love. So Jesus is underlying this, that he had the root of pure love in such a way that in each leaf of his flower you can see written the word love. Now he's comparing him to a plant, a flower, and so he says that each leaf in that flower is love. And therefore Aloysius, in a very wonderful way, reflected Christ himself. He was a miniature of Christ himself. But what renders him more beautiful and brilliant are the rays of my will, to which he was always submitted, notice the word. It was not the era of living in the divine will. Rays which gave such development to this flower as to render it unique in heaven and on earth. To have your PhD spiritually in love by the age of 23 is quite an achievement. Now, my daughter, if Aloysius is so beautiful because he bloomed from my humanity, what will it be for you and for all those who will possess the kingdom of my will? These flowers will not bloom from my humanity, but they will have their roots in the sun of my will. They will be flowers of the divine will. In the divine will is formed the flower of their lives, and they grow and they bloom in the very sun of my volition, which, jealous of these flowers, will keep them eclipsed within its own light. So this is a different reality altogether than the era of redemption. In each petal of these flowers, one will see all the specialities of the divine qualities. And they will be the enchantment of all heaven, and all will recognize in them the complete work of the Creator. Now, the complete work is creation, redemption, and sanctification. In other words, they will be like God. So I want to give you Psalm 82, verse 6. I said you are gods, all of you sons of the Most High. And while he was saying this, my sweet Jesus opened his breast and showed inside it an immense sun in which he was to plant all of these flowers of his divine will. And his love and jealousy towards them was so great that he would not let them bloom outside of his humanity, but inside himself. So this is a sanctity of a much higher order. Now notice he's saying the other saints are ad extra, and the saints of the divine will are ad intra. That's a different subject altogether. So let's come to June the 26th, 1926. And he's giving us one of these great keys to understanding whether we are in fact operating in the divine will or not, because the divine will is universal. And therefore all our prayer and all our concern should be universal if we are truly in the divine will. So Louisa said, I was doing my usual act in the Supreme Will according to my usual way. That is, embracing everything. That's the important bit. In other words, she was embracing creation, redemption, and everyone and everything. To be able to give back to the Creator the return of love and of glory that everyone owes him. So we do it in reparation and substitution for absolutely everyone. Jesus came out of my interior and said, my daughter, the little daughter of my will must not only think about and occupy herself with defending the universal rights of her Creator. Now, he's going from the Creator to our Blessed Mother in this, and it's very, very interesting. So Louisa understands that she has got to requite the Lord in love and glory and gratitude on behalf of all created beings. But he says that's not enough. But you must, of course, give him return of love and glory, for everyone owes him as if it were one, in such a way that he would find everything in her. In other words, we're to give him such a return that even if the others never said the words, we have paid him back, if I can use that language. Because our will involves everything and everyone. So if we're still at the stage of eliminating any group or any person from our prayers and from our thoughts and from our love, we're not in the divine will. We have to have all of creation and all human beings. Our will involves everything and everyone, and one who lives in it possesses universal ways. So this is a moment in which you reflect and you ask yourself, am I praying for every person, past, present and future? Am I concerned that they all arrive back at their true destiny? Anyone who lives in the divine will possesses universal ways. Therefore, she can give us everything, and we can recover everything. But there's something else you need to do, he says. That's what we're hoping you're doing anyway. But he says, our daughter, she must also defend the rights of the sovereign queen. Now notice he says, you defend the rights of the triune God first, and then our Blessed Mother. And he's going to explain why. She operated in a universal way, and therefore she had a love, a glory, a prayer, a reparation, a sorrow for her Creator, and for all and for each one. She did not let any act escape her, which creatures owed to their Creator. So she covered everything. And you see in these writings that the Lord is getting Louisa to cover everything as well. And in closing all in her maternal heart, she loved everyone. That's past, present and future. And she loved each person in a universal way. So it's the all and the one that's in the all. Because God loves every individual in the same way as he loves the whole lot. And so in her, we found all of our glory. She denied nothing to us. She gave us not only that which she was supposed to give us directly, that is, as a creature, but also that which the other creatures denied us. That's the reparation and the substitution. And to act as a magnanimous and a most loving mother who pours her own self out for her children, she generated everyone in her sorrowful heart. This is very, very important. So I want to give you John 19:26, where Jesus officially appointed her as the mother of all who believe. Each fiber of her heart was piercing sorrow in which she gave life to each one of her children up to the fatal blow of the death of her son, who was God. The sorrow of this death placed the seal of the regeneration of life upon the new children of the Blessed Mother. So we are the children of love and sorrow. And what he's saying is that from the time she conceived Jesus, she conceived all of us. And that she embraced all of our lives all the time. And that she has loved us in the divine will, which means loving us infinitely. Okay. Now, the consequences. A virgin queen who loved us so much, who defended all of our rights, a mother so tender, who had love and sorrows for all, deserves that our little newborn of the supreme will would love her for all. In other words, that we would love our Blessed Mother for the whole human race who doesn't love her. And that we would thank her for the rest of them who don't thank her. And that we would make reparation and substitution for all the others. So this mother deserves that our little newborn in the supreme will would love her for all, would requite her for all, and embracing all of her acts in our will, place her act united with hers. So not only do you give back thanks and praise for all that she has done, but we enter into her acts, so we actually participate in everything that she actually did. Because she is inseparable from us, her glory is ours, and our glory is hers. More so, since our will places everything in common. So we have to literally take Our Lady on board. Most of the people who come to the divine will have a great devotion to her anyway. And so all the Lord is asking us to do is step up and relate to her in a much higher plane. Louisa said, on hearing this, I was a little confused and as though unable to do what Jesus was saying. And I prayed him to give me the ability to do it. Now there's Louisa answering a lot of questions for us. If there's something in the divine will we don't fully understand and we feel we can't really enter into it, then you simply ask the Lord to enable you to do it and to bring you to do it and to do it within you, allowing you to grow into it. And so Jesus resumed his teaching and he told me, my daughter, my will contains everything. And as though jealous, it preserves all of its acts as if they were just one. And so it preserves all the acts of our Blessed Mother as well, as if they were all its own in that one act of his, of course, because she did everything in the divine will. And therefore, my will itself will make them present to you. So if we want to enter into her acts, if we want to unite ourselves with her in praying to the Father and in being part of that generation of souls on the earth in love and sorrow, then the Lord will make it available to us. He usually doesn't make things available if you're only curious and you have no intention of doing it. Now we come to a very, very important passage. And it's a passage dealing with universal rights. Now, you must know that one who has done good to all, who has loved all, and has operated in a universal way for God and for all, has rights over everything and over everyone. And with justice. Operating in a universal way is the divine way of operating. There's a very, very important statement, because it's telling you that if we are operating in the divine will, we are operating in a universal way also. So operating in a universal way is the divine way, and my celestial mother was able to operate with the ways of her creator because she possessed the kingdom of the divine will. Now notice the issue is possessing the kingdom of the divine will, not just knowing about it. And it was because she possessed the kingdom of the divine will, she could actually operate in this manner. So now, having operated in our supreme will, she has the rights of the possessions which she formed in our divine will. That's like saying, if I have made furniture, I have the right to actually own it. If she has formed all of this in the divine will, she has a right to own it. She has the right to possess it. So, she has the rights of the possessions which she formed in our kingdom. And who else can requite her if not someone else who lives in the divine will? In other words, because you're operating on the same level. In fact, only in this kingdom is there universal operation. If you listen to the prayers of people living in ordinary life, they're praying for me and my needs and the people who are immediately connected with me, but they're not concerned with the rights of every human being since Adam. Only in this kingdom is there universal operation. And the one who loves everyone, who embraces everyone, and from which nothing escapes, that's the way you operate in this kingdom. But you must know. We normally say you must know. I'm going to say you must realize. You must know that one who possesses the kingdom of my will on earth has the right to universal glory in heaven. Would you ever underline that in every color you can think of? That's the most astounding statement that Jesus could make to poor creatures who are trying to live in the divine will. Let me read it again. You must know or realize or grasp that if you possess the kingdom of the divine will on earth, that you have the right to universal glory in heaven. That is enough to go on a retreat. It is just enough to really set the fires of love burning in us. And Jesus said, and this is in a natural and simple way, because everything to do with God is very simple. My will embraces everything and involves everyone. So from one who possesses the divine will come all goods, along with the glory that these goods contain. And while universal glory comes from her, she also receives it. So we actually go back to God full of all kinds of goods. We actually take the divine will back with all that the divine will represents, all that it possesses. It's an incredible thing. So she not only does universal glory come from her, but she also receives it. And do you think it's trivial to possess universal glory in the celestial fatherland? She said. Therefore, he said, be attentive. The kingdom of the supreme will is immensely rich, and there are coins that spring forth. So everyone expects something from you, he says to Louisa. And unknowingly, the whole human race is expecting something from you and me as well. And also my mother wants the return of the universal love that she has given to all the generations. And you, in return, watch this, are due universal glory in the celestial fatherland. It is the exclusive inheritance of one who has possessed the kingdom of the divine will on earth. Now, just this paragraph alone is enough to go on a retreat for a week. That if you have lived in the depths of the divine will, if you are responding to the Lord as the way he asks of us, he says that the exclusive inheritance of one who possessed the divine will on earth is eternal glory. So I want to just give you John 7:37 to 39, that out of your own heart will flow fountains of living water. And this is the eternal security of the one who lives in the divine will. It's just massive. But the only thing you can do is meditate on it. No words of mine could illuminate it in any way. So let's come to June the 29th, 1926. And here he's coming to help us with the rounds. And he tells us that God left an image of himself in every single thing he created. And so it shouldn't be difficult for us to discern that image, and it shouldn't be difficult, therefore, for us to give him back the glory and the praise and the thanksgiving that he deserves. After I'd gone through the most bitter days of privations, Louisa said, have you noticed that in recent times she's not complaining? Big change. When my beloved Jesus came to cheer me, he spent several hours with me. Now, this is new. He hasn't done this since about volume 5 or 6. It's been a long, long time. He spent several hours with me, and he made himself seen at a very young age of a rare, enrapturing beauty. He sat on my bed near me and told me, my daughter, I know that you cannot be without me because I am more than your very life. Now, here you have an illustration of a very great love. That she loved him more than she loved her own life. She loved him quite literally, according to Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 10, with all her heart, all her soul, all her mind, and all her being. There was nothing else for anybody else. She truly did. And so he said, if I did not come, you would lack the sustenance of life. And this is because Louisa is not eating. She's hardly drinking. There is no sustenance for her body, and the only sustenance she has for her soul is Holy Communion and the coming of Jesus. So if he doesn't come, actually she would die. And so in all of the moanings that she made in the last number of volumes about quite literally she felt she was dying, she was. She wasn't actually exaggerating. But I find it wonderful that she's moved on from there, and she just barely mentioned the privations, but she emphasizes that when he came back, he spent real time with her, which I think is adorable. Besides, Jesus said, we have so many things to do together in the kingdom of the supreme will. Therefore, when you see that I don't come quickly, don't oppress yourself so much. Be sure that I will come. Now, he has spent 18 volumes trying to convince her that he will come back. Be sure that I will come. Because my coming is necessary for you and for me. They are now inseparable. Because I must see the things of my kingdom, and while directing it, I must enjoy it. So what he's saying is, I must see too, setting up the kingdom in you and making sure everything is there and putting everything in that must be there. And he said, I want to enjoy it as well, which I think is wonderful. That's like an artist enjoying the picture as they're actually doing it, or a sculptor doing the same thing. enjoying it as it happened. How can you have the slightest doubt that in a kingdom so longed for by me, the King of Triumph might actually be missing? Not possible. Therefore, he said, come into my arms that your Jesus may strengthen you. And with that, he took me in his arms, he clasped me tightly to his breast and rocked me like a child. And he said, sleep, sleep on my breast, my little newborn. In other words, he comforts her as in Psalm 131, my soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. Now, because she's in his arms, being very Italian, she doesn't want to sleep. She wants to talk. And he won't accept it. He wants her to sleep because he wants to heal. And so the healing takes place in sleep, as we know. So in the arms of Jesus, I was so very little and did not feel like sleeping. I wanted to enjoy Jesus and I wanted to tell him so many things. Now that I had the privilege of his prolonged presence, which is very unusual for a long time. But Jesus continued to rock me and I, without wanting to, fell asleep into a very sweet sleep. But while sleeping, I could hear the heartbeat of Jesus speaking. So notice that while she does actually sleep physically, she's actually awake. And that's what the bride in the Song of Songs says, I sleep, but my heart is awake. And she's listening to the heart of Jesus, her soul totally sensitive to his presence. And so I was able to hear the beating of the heart of Jesus speaking. It was saying, my will, for one beat, and then another heartbeat as though answering, I want to infuse love in the little daughter of my will. It's like as if she was listening into his inner thoughts. In the heartbeat, my will, a large circle of light formed. The divine will, utterly immense. And in the heartbeat, love, another tiny little circle inside of the great circle appeared. And while I was sleeping, Jesus made these circles formed by his heartbeat and would seal them into my whole person. Every single atom and molecule of her being was sealed in the divine will. There's a nice little prayer for you. Seal me, every part of my being, body, soul, and spirit, in your divine will, Lord. He would seal them in my whole person. I felt I was being all fortified and strengthened in the arms of Jesus, and how happy I felt. But clasping me more tightly to his breast, Jesus woke me up and said, my little daughter, let's go around the whole of creation in which the supreme will has its life. Does its distinct act in each created thing and triumphant of itself magnifies and glorifies all of its supreme qualities in a perfect way. Come, he said, let's do some rounds. Okay. He begins with the sky. If you look at the sky, he said, your eye cannot see its boundaries. Now, the first thing he wants us to look at is the immensity of God. Wherever it looks, there is sky. No one can see any of its boundaries. No one can tell where it ends or where it begins. This is the image of our supreme being. What you would say is this is the image of the immensity of God's supreme being. And you know in the volumes leading up to volume 19, that Louisa said very often that when she entered into the divine will in a conscious way, that she was in a place that had absolutely no measurement and there was no way out or anything else because she had entered into that supreme immensity of God. And of course, if we could enter into the immensity of God, we wouldn't allow the nothings of everyday life to get to us. So this is an image of our supreme being, which has no beginning and no end. And in the azure sky, our will praises and glorifies our eternal being. Now, before you go to bed tonight, look at the sky and read this again. In the azure sky, our will praises and glorifies our eternal being, which has no beginning and no end. So here we not only look at the immensity of God, but the eternity of God as well. This sky, studded with stars, is the image of our being. Just as the sky is only one thing, so is the divinity one single act. Here we are into our singularity again. But in the multiplicity of stars, our works ad extra, which descend from this single act, and the effects and the works of this single act are innumerable. So out of this one single act comes this immensity of acts. The astronomers today have come to realise this, but they refuse point blank to put the name or the word God on the first act. But they know that out of one act, everything else actually emerged. And that's what he's saying. Out of this one act, everything else came. And in the stars, our will magnifies and glorifies the effects and the multiplicity of our works, which include the angels, man, and all created things. So he's saying, looking at the stars, you can praise him for everything he has created. See how beautiful it is, he said, to live in my will, in the unity of this supreme light. That's 1 Timothy 6:16. God lives in unapproachable light. Not only to live in the divine will, but to be aware of the meaning of all created things. You see, if most people on this earth were aware of the reality of creation, nobody would commit suicide. They would be able to praise and glorify God, and they would be able to find solutions knowing that God was all around them. So how beautiful it is to live in the divine will and the unity of this supreme light, and to be aware of the meaning of all created things. And thirdly, how beautiful it is to praise, magnify and glorify the supreme creator with his own divine will in all our images. In other words, we join him in what he's doing. So you do that in all our images, which each created thing actually contains. But move on and look at the sun, he said. Now, he never leaves out the sun. Look at the sun. Under the vault of the heavens, one can see a limited circumference of light, which contains light and heat, and descending down below invests the whole earth. This is the image of the light and the love of our supreme maker, but also his omnipresence. He invests everything. He's in everything. He's everywhere. This is the image of the light and love of the supreme maker, who loves everyone and does good to all, regardless of our behavior. From the height of his majesty, he descends down below, deep into the depths, even into hell. Why would you say even into hell? Nothing can exist unless the divine will permits it to exist. He could so easily have obliterated the creatures who arrive in hell. I want you to think about that. There is an aspect of God we don't even look at. But I do know from a testimony I read many years ago that one of the dwellers in hell was allowed to speak. And the soul said, I have to say it. I'm forced to say it. I don't want to say it because I hate the one who is making me say it. But God is merciful to us. I should have received a much greater hell than I did. And he gave me the smallest hell that justice had to express itself in. I won't go on with it, but just to give you an idea that his love and his mercy and his presence is everywhere. Everywhere. There's nowhere that he won't be. And so it is just so wonderful to look up into the sky. I call it the tabernacle of the sky. From the height of his majesty, the Lord descends down below, not only to the earth, deep into the hearts, even into hell, but he does it quietly. He does it without clamour, wherever he is, just like the apparitions after Easter, very quietly, no razzmatazz. Oh, how our will glorifies and magnifies our eternal light, number one, our inextinguishable love, I think that's fantastic. I also call it incomprehensible love. Our all-seeingness. So his omniscience. Our will murmurs in the sea. And in the immensity of the waters which hide innumerable fish of every species and colour. It glorifies our immensity that envelops everything and holds all things as though in the palm of his hand. Our will glorifies the image of our immutability in the firmness of the mountains, the image of our justice in the roaring of the thunder and in the bolt of lightning. The image of our joy in the little bird that sings, trills and warbles. The image of our moaning love in the turtle dove that moans. The image of the continuous call that we make to man in the lamb that bleats, saying with each bleating, me, me, come to me, come to me. And our will glorifies us in the continuous call that we make to all creatures. All created things have a symbol of ours and an image of ours. And our will has the commitment to magnify us and to glorify us in all of our works. Because since the work of creation is the work of the supreme fiat, it was fitting for the divine will to preserve our glory, whole and permanent, in all created things. I think there is a whole round to the divine attributes that you can get on the internet. And it's very beautiful. Now he says, our supreme will wants to give this commitment as an inheritance to one who must live in the unity of this light. So since we are living in the divine will, the Lord wants us to pick up this glorification of the divine will and enter into it. Because it would not be fitting to live in its light and not identify with the acts of the supreme fiat. We have to identify. We have to echo and repeat. Therefore, my little daughter, all created things, as well as my will, await you in each created thing to repeat its very acts, to glorify and magnify your Creator with our very divine will. Now, who can say all the images of our Creator that all creation encloses, Louisa says. If I wanted to say everything, I'd never end. So in order not to be too long, I had to say a few things because I had to obey. It's a pity she didn't go on. It's one of the occasions where I really am sad that she didn't go on, because obviously she was given a very wonderful revelation there. So let's go on to July the 1st, 1926. And I have a VIP on this one. Although you could put a VIP on everything. There's no sanctity outside of the divine will. It's actually that simple. So Jesus is going to explain for us the difference between the saints of old and the saints of the divine will. Okay. I was doing my usual acts in the supreme volition and I thought to myself, how is it possible that among the many saints of the Old Testament who have so distinguished themselves with the power of miracles like Moses and Elijah and the many prophets, and among so many saints after the coming of our Lord, who have rendered themselves so marvellous because of their virtues and miracles, that none of these possess the kingdom of the divine will, and none of them have lived in the unity of the light, it seems incredible. Now, I don't think that represents Louisa's thoughts. I think the Lord put that into Louisa's head because it's our trouble. It's our problem, and it's one of the questions that people ask quite frequently. So the answer that the Lord gives here is actually very valuable for all of you who are teaching others. Very valuable. Okay. So while I was thinking of this, my sweet Jesus came out from within my interior, and clasping me to himself, he told me, my daughter, yes, it is really true, that until now, no one has possessed the kingdom of my will. He's not including his mother, of course. That's all the rest of us apart from her. Okay, that no one has possessed the kingdom of my will or enjoyed all the fullness of the unity of the light that it contains. Had it been so, since it is the thing that interests me the most, that glorifies me the most, and that no less will place all the divine rights in safety and will complete the work of creation and redemption. And not only this, but will bring to the creature the greatest good that can exist either in heaven or on earth. I would have acted in such a way as to make it known, surely. Just as I have made known the many virtues and the wonders of my saints, I would have made known the one who had possessed the kingdom of my will, which I hold so dear, so as to transmit it to others. Notice that so as to transmit it to others. This gift is not for one. It's for everyone who will come. And so to transmit this to others by imitating the one who possessed it. And of course, now that Louisa lived in the divine will, the rest of us can imitate her by entering in as well. So in the next paragraph, he is going to tell us quite clearly the difference between the two. The saints of the Old Testament found themselves in the same condition as Adam. A divine repairer was missing. In other words, redemption hadn't even come. They were still living under the age of justice. A divine repairer was missing who, while rejoining the human will and the divine, was to pay the debt of guilty man in a divine way. That was all in the future. So how could Moses or Elijah or any of the prophets of old have entered the divine will? They couldn't. It wasn't even time for redemption. However, both the ancient saints and the modern ones have taken from my will as much as they have known. Now, this is extremely important if you're teaching anybody. Notice they took what they knew. If I know I have €30 in the bank, I know I can withdraw €30 from the bank, but if I don't know I have it there, how can I withdraw it? I can't. So they took from the divine will as much as they knew about. The very miracles they performed were particles of the power of my will communicated to them. So all my saints have lived, watch. Number one, some have lived in the shadow of my will. Number two, some have lived in the reflections of its light. Number three, some have actually submitted to its power. Number four, some have submitted to the order of its commands. Because there's no sanctity outside of the divine will. And so in all the spiritual books from all the saints and all the spiritual writers that you can get for the past 2,000 years, they've all said that you've got to enter in and do the divine will as much as possible if you want to become holy. So he's given us four different ways there. But they have possessed of it, he says, of the divine will, the little they have known. They could only take what they knew about. If they didn't know about it, they couldn't take it. And Jesus didn't reveal this for another 2,000 years after redemption. No more, because only when a good is known does a person actually want it and arrive at possessing it. No one can possess a good or a property without knowing it. That's like saying, I have been left something as an inheritance, but I wasn't told. So how do I know there's anything going to come in the bank? How do I know a cheque is going to come in the post? I don't know. I'm ignorant. So I won't go looking. I won't check it out. And it's exactly the same with the divine will. If you don't know that these extraordinary gifts are being offered by the Lord, you will not go looking. And suppose one did possess it without knowing it. That good is as good as dead for him, because the life of knowledge is missing. So he's saying, if you don't know about the gift, you cannot possibly use it. It's that simple. So in the next paragraph, he talks about the book of my divine will. As far as I know, this is the first time he uses this expression. Now, since my divine will is the greatest thing, which encompasses everything, and all things, from the greatest to the smallest, remain dissolved in it, because if we're not in the divine will in that sense that he's preserving us alive, then we wouldn't be here. So many things should be known about my will so as to surpass what is known about creation, about redemption, and about all the virtues and the spiritual knowledge that all the saints have given to us. My will was to be a book for each step, for each act, a book for each created thing. That's exactly what you're getting in these 36 volumes. The whole earth was to be filled with volumes of knowledge regarding the kingdom of my will, such as to surpass the number of created things. Now, where are these books? There is no book. Since a few sayings are known about the divine will, while it should be the origin of all knowledge and of every subject. What the Lord is saying is that this supreme knowledge has got to be made known. And I want to give you two references. One is Isaiah 11:9, and the other is Habakkuk 2:14. And both of them are saying the same thing, that the Lord wants the earth to be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters will cover the sea. And it's then that humanity will actually know the fullness of what God has given to them. And this is what Jesus is saying here, that an immense amount of material is required in order to get across this knowledge to us. And here we are on volume 19, and we're only halfway through. It's quite amazing. And yet everything we read is just immense treasure. And you could stay with that for life. So the importance of the knowledge, and this is the very reason why we set up the classes, to make sure that the knowledge gets out to other people. The knowledge gets out, then there's the possibility of people opening up to the grace and opening up to the reality. But if they don't have the knowledge, they can't do it. So Jesus says that the divine will should be the origin of all knowledge and of every subject that we study. Being the life of everything, the divine will should be on everything, like the image of the king impressed on the currency and which circulates in a kingdom. It should be like the light of the sun that shines over each plant to give it life. It should be like water that quenches the thirst of burning lips. It should be like food that satiates a hungry man after a long fast. Everything should be filled with the knowledge regarding my will. The earth should be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And if it's not so, it is a sign that the kingdom of my will is not known and therefore is not possessed. Now, when Isaiah and Habakkuk gave us that piece of information, it was for the future. It was for a glorious day in the future. But you and I are living in that glorious day. Would you perhaps be able to tell me which saint said that he possessed the kingdom and the unity of the light of the supreme volition? You wouldn't be able to say it. And when I was sitting with this today, the thing that really struck me was one of our most famous writers is St. John of the Cross. Brilliant writer. And he considered that reaching union with God to be the absolute ultimate achievement of a life. And if you go back to volume 1, you'll find that Louisa had 3 experiences of union with God. So she surpassed John of the Cross, which was about 17, and then went up and up and up and up into the divine will. So this is how great this revelation actually is. So he says, no saint has ever claimed that. I myself spoke little, he said, about it during the days of his incarnation. Had I wanted to speak extensively about the kingdom of my will and about wanting to form it in man, just as innocent Adam had possessed it, since this is the highest point and the nearest point to God and the closest to the divine likeness, and since the fall of Adam was still fresh, they would all have become discouraged. They would have turned their backs on me, and they would have said, if innocent Adam couldn't manage, nor had the constancy to live in the sanctity of this kingdom, so much so as to cause his own fall and the fall of the generations into miseries, passions, and irreparable evils, how could we, guilty ones, live in a kingdom so holy? Now there's the sheer logic of people who hadn't yet experienced redemption. So Jesus is showing us that without redemption, you couldn't possibly go into the kingdom of the divine will. So this kingdom is beautiful, yes, but we could say it's not for us. Not only this, but since my will is the highest point, the ways, the means of transportation, the stairs, the decent clothes, oh dear, what a change that would be for 2021, decent clothes. Have you seen any? The appropriate foods were all necessary in order to be able to dwell in this kingdom. So look at the enormous amount of preparation and adaptation on our part to enter this kingdom. So my coming upon the earth served to form all this. Each one of my sayings in the gospel, each one of my works, my pains, my prayers, my examples, my instituted sacraments, were ways that I formed, were means of transportation to let them arrive more quickly. They were stairs to let them ascend, John 1:51. It can be said that I gave them the clothes of my humanity. Now, if you go to Luke chapter 15, you get that absolutely wonderful parable in which the sinner is clothed once he comes back to the Lord in redemption. So I gave them the clothes of my humanity, reddened with my blood, and I let them be clothed decently in this kingdom of my will. Now, clothing decently in the kingdom of the divine will is that you put your sins behind, you accept the fullness of redemption, you grow more and more and more in union with God, and you're clothed with his merits, his grace, his everything. Decent clothing. So I let them be clothed decently in this kingdom of my will, so holy, which in creation the uncreated wisdom established to give to man as an inheritance. Now, the uncreated wisdom is the way the Old Testament referred to God, but it was God the Son, the second person, the uncreated wisdom. And when you go to the Gospel of John, it's that uncreated wisdom who became incarnate for us. So, even though I spoke little about this, Jesus said, because when I speak at time and circumstance. In other words, God's kairos time, his intervention in humanity. And so he will only speak as the necessity arises and as the usefulness of the good that he's presenting can be utilized, and that my word contains, it must be enclosed in it. Every word, every action of his was preparation for what was to come. But we had to go through the preparation first, and the preparation is redemption. So instead of speaking, I did the deeds, intending to speak to you about the kingdom of my will. I love that. So he's talking about the days of his incarnation, and he said, no, I had to do all the preparation there, but I intended speaking to you. That was 2,000 years later, Psalm 90, verse 5. With the Lord, 1,000 years is like a single day. And so when you look at God's time clock, it's nothing. When you look at ours, it's very, very long time. So now he says, how could they possess the divine will if they didn't even have full knowledge of it? They couldn't. They couldn't possibly. On the other hand, you must know that all the manifestations I've made to you about the divine will, all the manifestations about its prodigies and its goods, what the soul must do to be able to settle in this kingdom, VIP, put that on that sentence, everything we must do to actually settle in this kingdom, my very expressed will for man to return into my kingdom, and how I have done everything, creation, redemption, and he's doing the sanctification in us as well, so that he might come to possess my kingdom, which he has lost. Now, all of this, he said, these are bonds of transmission. These are the doors that I open to let them enter. These are the donations that I make in order to enable them to come forward. These are the laws that I provide so that they know exactly how to behave. These are the instructions so that they know how to live in the divine will. And this is the intelligence that they need in order to grasp the whole thing. If all of this was missing, how could they possess this kingdom of my will? and it's only available now in Louise's writings. It would be as if somebody wanted to go and live in another kingdom without a passport, without even knowing its laws or its customs or its dialect. Poor one, his entry would be impossible, and indeed they would be an intruder. An intruder means you come without anybody's invitation. They would be so ill at ease that they themselves would want to go out of the kingdom they know nothing about. And that's true. It's very easy to slip out of the divine will. So, now, my daughter, does it not seem easier to you, more encouraging, more within the reach of human nature, that after they have known all about the kingdom of redemption, in which the blind, the lame, and the sick were healed, because the blind can't enter the kingdom of my will. Now, there you would be talking about the spiritually blind. Okay? Because in the divine will are straight and glowing, all in the divine will are straight, not bent. You remember the case in Luke 13, verses 10 to 17, of the woman who was bent over for 18 years and Jesus had to straighten her up. So everyone is straightened up. In other words, your problems are solved. You're straightened out. Your past is dealt with. You're living now and you're living fully. And therefore, you're happy and at peace. And you have the joy of the Lord for your strength. And here's a very this is so clear that you can't actually live in the divine will if you're still carrying bundles of burdens. If you're still carrying the past as a weight on your foot, like a prisoner. If you're still stuck in the problems of the past, you are not in the divine will. I mean, living in it 24/7, 365. You're still obviously trying to live in it. So the blind can't enter the kingdom of my will, for in the divine will all are straight and glowing with health, finding all possible means in the kingdom of redemption and the very passport of my passion. Now notice, you can see why Louisa got us all meditating on the passion every single day, that it's the passport so that we really enter in. So my passion and death are the passport in order to pass into the kingdom of my will, animated at the sight of such a great good. In other words, you perk up, realizing what an incredible thing this is, what an incredible privilege. They will decide to take possession of it. So in spite of all the repentance you have to do, all the changes, all the adaptation, everything, you'll still want it. And I believe that anyone who has come to understand the divine will in any possible way couldn't possibly not want it, no matter what it costs. Therefore, be attentive and do not want to constrain or reduce the goods which are in the kingdom of my will. And you, that's Louisa, do this when you don't manifest everything of what I've told you. Because, watch this, underline this in every colour again. Because knowledge is the bearer of the gift. This is the very reason why we set up classes. Knowledge is the bearer of the gift. Once they know, they will ask the Lord. They will enter into it. Without knowing, they can't do it. And if now I abound in knowledge of the divine will, it's all gifts that I make to everybody. And in these gifts, I establish the more or the less to be placed in the kingdom of my will for the good of those who are to possess it. There is absolutely divine food for you. I think it's fantastic. But you now know why I encourage you to set up classes. So thank you. And I'll see you next week. God bless.